Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello, good evening and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast, the only rugby podcast that believes wearing a mask is like trying to keep a fart in your pants or your trousers. But
that's necessarily shared by all members of this podcast.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I'm not going to go into it, but I thought I would open the show with a little gag because, you know, masks and it. Fucking Omicron. Have you seen that the Omicron variant, Omicron B, is an anagram of no crimbo and also moronic?
Phil, how do we shut him up?
I was trying to think about whether I could educate him about where the naming came from, but then I thought it's gone past that. I think we should. Yeah.
You can educate me on whatever you like.
We'll just leave him to his own little devices, I think, Doug.
I think he's not far off disappearing down a rabbit hole we may never get him back from.
No, mate. I'm not a weird cunt. Not quite, anyway. We're Mall Over Podcast. You've already heard the dulcet tones of the Chinese lensman. Welcome, Doug.
Hello.
And from his isolation dungeon somewhere in mid Cornwall, Phil, farm vet, handsome. How you doing? Housewife's favourite.
Yeah, a lot better than I was tail end of last week, to be honest.
Are you feeling better now, mate? You all right?
Heading in the right direction. Not a long way off perfect, but yeah, got out of breath walking to the end of the garden and back. But I think that's just a lack of exercise.
I was going to say, is that fitness thing as opposed to an illness thing?
That's not having run since doing my ankle back in September.
Yeah, I mean, that you just add into your list of ailments. We're going to talk about some rugby. We're not going to do a traditional rundown of the weekend's action because, you know, let's be fair, you've probably either all seen it or all heard about it or whatever. So we're going to give some do some chat about a couple of subjects, and then we're going to do our new semi-regular money line feature towards the end, where Phil and I are going to try and guess the odds on this week's Premiership matches and maybe have a little bit of a chat about what's to come. But Doug, you wanted to chat a little bit to start off this week's podcast about the Championship and how that race is hotting up to head into the Prem.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's been keeping an eye on it. I mean, if you haven't, you probably should be, because it's shaping up to be one of the... In all of the last sort of 10 years of Championship action, there may have been like a couple of seasons where you had maybe Bristol and Worcester fighting out for one promotion spot. But in a year where there's so much jeopardy and a little bit of sort of lackadaisicalness about the nature of the Championship, where everyone thought, well, Saracens are up, no one's been relegated, so therefore Ealing will just stroll to the league. There's a real sort of four-way struggle for promotion in that league. And in a time when we're looking at, you know, being 3 or 4 weeks away from the Premiership being dead rubbers, waiting for the playoffs to start, it could be that the Championship is where the most interesting rugby is going to be happening for a good deal of the season. And I cannot believe that you can't watch it anywhere. It's astonishing to me that this rugby is not available for human consumption beyond going to the grounds and watching it, which admittedly we could all do, but the profile of that competition could be a measure of, like, it could be elevated to a level where people want to watch it regardless of there being no relegation or promotion for the next couple of years, because it seems to me like there's games going on every week in that division that could be just unbelievable to watch.
You think the RFU in their current standing, I mean, we've seen it demonstrated over the past 18 months or so that it doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg to even set up some kind of live feed with a commentator, even if it was on the...
Was it you that said Pirates had wanted to shoot one of their matches but were told that they couldn't because it didn't Premiership standards?
That's right.
That to me is just insane.
But they were doing... I mean, if you look at what they were doing for the Premier 15s, I know like Nick Heath and Tom May do a lot of commentary on it, didn't they? But a lot of that is on the Premier 15s website and on their Facebook page and stuff. And it's only almost like a single gantry camera streamed live. You know, it doesn't have to be a multi-camera setup. It doesn't have to be a sophisticated load of stuff. If you can make it accessible to people, and like you say, the top four teams in that league, your Pirates, Doncaster, Jersey and Ealing, there's more than likely going to be a top six clash pretty much every week that's going to be really worth a watch. And
it's just so short-sighted, honestly. I'm almost despair a little bit about it, because they've had a golden opportunity. What exactly are the RFU doing at the moment? Because all they seem to be doing is pulling money out of grassroots rugby, pulling money out of the England setup, pulling money out of women's rugby, pulling money out of the Championship. To what end? To pay 25 blokes every 3 months a load of money to play for England? And so I think a load of blokes at a corporate hospitality venue.
I think the problem is they're using case studies from our very near neighbours. Case studies where you've taken relatively successful, albeit not necessarily that commercially successful, multi-tier setups, and then they've consolidated them into a regional approach and with a ring-fenced approach. And they've seen a degree of kind of increased performance at a competitive level from certainly the Irish regions. Scottish national team are doing relatively well, and they're looking at them going, well, maybe that's what we should be doing, and concentrating on our core product of England rugby and trying to build that through and the Premiership, that we're going to ring fence and we're going to bring everything into this one solid product. But the reality is our rugby playing environment and infrastructure within England, because of the quantity of clubs, the quantity of players involved, the quantity of schools that are involved as well, is a bit more like our cross-channel neighbours in the French, who have an incredibly successful top 14. They have an incredibly successful, competitive second division and are reaping the rewards at both a commercial and an international level. And I think they've taken the ship and decided they were going to try and put it down the canal rather than going out into the wide open ocean.
The problem that I see is that the RFU don't have any real jurisdiction over the Premiership, and the Premiership is dictating really what's happening. Because at the end of this season, when this one team goes into the Premiership to make it a 14-team Premiership for what I believe is a further two seasons before there's the potential for any promotional relegation, that 14th team is then given an opportunity to buy shares into PRL to then become one of the 14 shareholding teams. And once that happens, the door's going to be firmly closed again, because there's no way that when they get in there, anyone's going to vote to bring back promotion and relegation anyway. It's the most nonsensical thing I think I've ever heard.
I mean, to me, the way the RFU should be looking at this is going, right, Premiership, you're your own thing.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting nothing from us. And if that means we can't have the players, we won't have the players. Because, believe me, the players will want to play for England. You know, that's where they're making a great deal of money. And if England could solve this whole debate by just going, well, we'll pick England players wherever you play, we'll pull our money out of the Premiership, and we'll put that money directly back into the Championship, and the Premiership can go on its own and be lucky, and we'll have our pyramid system, and we'll see how we get on. They're never going to do that, obviously, but
if they were to, you'd find very quickly that the Premiership clubs want to be involved in it. It's so much like the European Super League discussions that were being had, where all of a sudden
that's essentially what the Premiership is.
Yeah, it is. It's owned by the clubs, certainly the best part of it, or 49% of it, or whatever, is owned by the clubs. The rest of it's owned entirely by a commercial venture. RFU have zero ownership and therefore zero say about what they do.
So
television
why
rights got nothing to do with the RFU.
Money into it.
Yeah,
no idea. Because what the RFU care about is England rugby, and they perceive that they've got to put money in because the clubs have got them over a barrel.
Eligibility and releasing the players
release clauses,
from contracts.
Yeah.
Well, you've only got to look at
what happens if they don't. Is the RFU go moaning to World Rugby, and World Rugby say, well, actually, we can't really have a say over this because it's a commercial venture, and the only people who could then have a say over it is the European club rugby thing, whatever they're called, who do the
ECPR.
Yeah. But then they're not going to go, actually, we don't want the English clubs involved because they bring value to the product. So everybody's over a barrel over this, apart from the Premiership.
Yeah. And they'll make money. Well, I say make money. Some of them make money. Very small amount do. But yeah, so...
And they'll make money out of the pockets of their chairman.
Yeah, and well, absolutely. But then they're propped up by the money that they get from the RFU to release their marquee players. And all that will happen eventually is that the international windows will get smaller and smaller. Players will have injuries, in inverted commas, so they're not released for England duty. And it'll become in this club versus country battle.
And summer tours will be like the autumn tour has been for Japan and Tonga. Yeah. It'll be a second string of players going on a summer tour because there'll be people pulling out with bruised metatarsals 2 days before the game so that they can stay with their clubs because that's who's paying their wages.
And all the while, the Championship will disintegrate into nothing because where's the commercial value in a competition where there is no real jeopardy? I mean, I see that. I think that about the Premiership at the moment. You've only got to look at some of the games that are going on in the Premiership and that have done for the past 18 months to realise that no relegation and zero jeopardy just leads to general apathy. And with the Championship, you look at... Yeah, I mean, I'd love to put I'd love to find a number of players currently playing regular first team rugby at the moment that have played for Championship clubs.
There's hundreds of them, mate.
I know there are, but
we've sort of discussed that at length. I mean, my I'd like to take it back to how there was a time, if you can remember, when 3D TV was a thing.
Yeah.
And I worked quite extensively on that. And one of my sort of, it ended up failing. But one of the things that I used to take into meetings that I had with certain parties that were involved in it was that if you don't believe in this as providers of this service and producers of this kind of television, why is anyone that's out there going to buy it? Because they'll understand that even the people that are making it don't believe in it. And I feel like that's how the Premiership is at the moment, how the Championship is at the moment. Why should anyone care about it? And why should anyone, why would you ever sponsor a Championship rugby team? Why would you ever get involved with a Championship rugby team on a corporate level? Or why would you ever use it as an aid to business when even the governing body of that league that's written all over the names of the branding and all over the names of the clubs clearly don't believe in it? It seems mental to me that anyone would be involved in it. And for just a minimal amount of foresight and almost not taking a punt, but just having a little bit of conviction around what you could achieve with that product, it could change the whole rugby landscape. And my guess would be that they're being asked not to by the Premiership clubs for fear of their product being diminished as well. I think there's a little bit of an element of, you know, let's keep the fans that we have got for us and not for anyone else.
So to add context to that, Doug, the top sponsor listed on the Cornish Pirates website is Penzance Leisure Centre.
I was just looking at that to see who the shirt sponsors were for the Championship rugby clubs.
So because they're advertising to people who are going to come to the gate. So they're advertising to that 1,000 to 3,000 people who are going to turn up to a home match. You're not going to bring in the big bucks doing that. And if you're not going to bring in the big bucks because it's not on telly, you're also not going to help build that product. It's a circular system. If you look in football at the clubs that have a decent FA Cup run, the non-league, lower league clubs, that end up getting a lot of money through gate receipts for those games, but also end up then getting exposure. And as a result of that exposure, are then all negotiating better sponsorship deals. It's become self-perpetuating. But I mean, probably one of the first things that's worked down this direction, or maybe it wasn't one of the first things, but one of the big things is a loss of a pyramidal cup competition. And instead we've had various incarnations of a shitty Premiership Cup or an Anglo-Welsh Cup that nobody cares about, that becomes an under-21s cup for the team.
I'd stop short. Like, you know, we said about a Pilkington Cup from all levels, where you can have your amateur guys that would then get weeded out as you go further up the pyramid, blah, blah, blah. I'd settle for a cup competition that just involved the Championship clubs.
Straight knockout.
Yeah.
32 clubs, or yeah, call it, I don't know, 26 clubs, and those top six from the Premiership get a bye to the second round.
Yeah. Or just have a bye. Yeah, just have a straight
knockout competition.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree. And at least it gives those Championship clubs the ability for some further exposure as well. I was just trying to look at the sponsors. I mean, the Jersey Reds were a little bit different. They had some fairly major backing as far as sponsorship goes within there.
Probably companies based in the tax haven of Jersey.
Santander, banks, etc. But yeah, you look at some of the others, Doncaster Knights, their red kit was sponsored by a company called MF Hire, Tool Hire Company. Like, what national business, national sponsor is going to get behind a Championship when they've got no when they've got no national exposure.
And yet here we are flogging women's rugby to death, which is clearly an inferior product than the championship. You know, trying to fool ourselves into thinking that that product's worth the investment that the championship isn't.
And I suppose that's kind of the thing, isn't it? You know, could it be surmised that money that could be used to expose the championship is being funneled into?
Well, I mean, the thing with all that is the Premiership aren't mugs; they're cottoning on. I mean, even Northampton now have teamed up with Loughborough, so the plan is that, you know, what we'll do is we'll just piggyback off these women's teams and we'll get a bit of goodwill and maybe a little bit of extra income because we're funding this women's team.
We'll look like great guys.
That's driving fans away from Championship rugby, because a lot of those teams, you look at sort of Darlington, Modon Park, they were always a good women's team and they got a men's team in the National League. It just, Hartbury, they're now aligned with Gloucester still, and you know, it just I don't know. I'm not really sure what the answer is, because it doesn't seem like anyone really cares apart from pretty much everyone that's into rugby.
Yeah.
Outside of an RFU suit.
And that's the problem, isn't it? We don't have any way to make anything happen.
I don't know how many more seasons we have to go through saying that nobody wants the Premiership Cup before they understand that nobody wants the Premiership Cup.
Yeah.
And how many Premiership squads we need with 70 plus players when only 20 of them ever play or 30 of them ever play.
I think the problem is, Doug, that the top guys at the RFU don't, or the Premiership don't listen to our podcast. That's the big issue.
Well, it's not just us, our podcast, is it?
It's not just us.
No, I know. But yeah, like the whole Premiership Cup thing, you know what? I don't really mind there being an under 23s cup or a second team cup or whatever you want to call it to stick in.
Well, call it that then. Don't call it the Premiership.
But call it that. Exactly. Exactly. Call it that and give the Championship sides an opportunity to get some exposure through.
It's
something else.
It's the LDV Vans trophy equivalent. It's like putting the under
23s. It's not even that, mate. It's not even that. It's the under 23s league in the Premiership.
The football combination.
The reserve teams and they have the under 23s. So even, you know, the older players can't get a game anymore.
Yeah.
They're too old to play for the under 23s. So it just, why is the Premiership Cup given television time, but the second tier of English rugby isn't?
Again, it's...
Why is it funded? Why is it sponsored?
But again,
I don't understand.
Again, actually thinking about it, they don't even need the Premiership Cup in whatever format it is, because they've got the A-League.
They haven't got the A-League at the moment, have they? Because of all the COVID regs.
But in theory, that product has been there.
I mean, why do we need an A-League?
It's given game time to the squad to develop them to become part of the players.
All the A-League does, if you actually go back through the history of the A-League, is give clubs the opportunity to keep more players on the book so that nobody else can.
But in a lot of cases,
they're sending out SOSs to local clubs.
Guest players. Even your
Bedfords at Northampton and Ampt Hill and Richmond. They're quite literally going to fourth-tier clubs to pick players to play in the A-League. Wasps did it a couple of years back where they basically...
But that's second-team rugby throughout every tier of it, isn't it?
Yeah, but that shouldn't be second-team professional rugby, reserve team rugby. Shouldn't be, you know... That's the point. When they've got squads of 60 players or 50 players or however many it is, and they still can't fulfill an A-League fixture, and you're getting someone from fucking Met Police or, you know, Scunthorpe Paraplegics to come and play for you, you know, what goodness is that providing for anyone?
Other than the other players, like, you're right, there's an issue
For the one guy that gets to turn up and put on a wash shirt on a Monday
night.
And probably steals the stash.
Which will immediately go in the clubhouse above the bar.
Yeah,
play for Wasps. It's for the Sean Lonsdales and the likes who play in those fixtures so that then the following season when they're playing in the first team fixtures, they've had more exposure and more game time for things. And they could do that out on loan to a Championship side. It's the other way to do it.
And that would be for me a better. I'd rather see that more dual registrations, and
you could find a way to do that. But kind of allowing salary cap.
Absolutely,
privileges is the wrong term.
But then that increases the quality of the Championship. It then gets more youngsters coming through for the Championship clubs because they're playing potentially with these better players. It allows those wage bills to become a little bit more sustainable in the Championship because a lot of it's offset by some of the Premiership clubs. And those borderline players are still getting regular, week in, week out competitive rugby to either find their way back to fitness from injury or to blood themselves if they're a bit younger in the ways of professional rugby. But yeah, with the support of the Premiership and the RFU.
It doesn't need Premiership. The Premiership, it doesn't need support. It needs to be its own thing. I think the time has come for the RFU to cut the reins on the Premiership. And if they don't release their players, so be it.
I mean, that's never going to happen, is it? So why not think about it the other way around and go, well, actually, what about if the PRL made it the Premiership 2 or, you know, whatever it might be?
I mean, Premiership 2 is a great idea, but I don't think there's enough clubs. Now, the answer to that would be, as I mentioned a year or so ago, whereby you say anyone that wants to be part of this has to demonstrate that they can afford it and they can buy in and put money in holding to protect against bankruptcy and all that kind of stuff. Unfortunately, I think there'd only be three or four extra clubs, but you could make it work with a two conference system like they do in the URC. There's any number of ways you can make it happen to increase the pool of professional teams in the UK, in England. But I mean, you could go as far as to ask, well, do the Scottish provinces want to join the English structure? Do the Welsh provinces want to join the English structure to increase that competitiveness? And
Because we said this before, didn't we? Because if you take those,
they effectively did in the amateur days, right? They all played against all the Welsh clubs, played against English clubs.
Yeah, so why not have two 14 team leagues, or you know, again,
away. I mean, ultimately, that doesn't solve the issue of getting the Championship clubs, the traditional English pyramid. It doesn't solve that issue. It just moves the issue because then you've got more professional clubs and you've got the issue is, certainly from my perspective, I want, as a rugby fan, I think it is negligent from the RFU not to have that, their marquee division, their marquee domestic league, not being shown to the public.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good place to end that. On that point, so we'll move on from there. Last week, some big news coming out of World Rugby around eligibility criteria. A bit odd. It seems an odd time to announce it right after the Autumn Internationals have finished. Lots of interested parties, but Phil, what do you make of the revised eligibility criteria and how it's going to impact international rugby moving forward?
So I think I still have this fear that and I actually raised this, Dan Leo has been the primary proponent of this pushing it forwards. I raised it on Twitter to him probably 5 or 6 months ago, saying that is the risk not that it almost encourages even more the first tier, the top tier nations going and harvesting players from second tier countries, because those players then know they can go back and play for those countries at a later stage. And some of the measures that are in place minimize the risk of that, but that is still very much a risk. And the risk was there always anyway, that anybody who's half decent, who's Tongan or Samoan, they'll try to get capped for New Zealand, Australia, whoever, so that those players are then sealed into those countries. But I do think it's a good thing that people who played for one country can then go back and play for the country of their birth. And that's effectively, that proviso, I think, is a really good thing. That it's not that you can say, I don't know, play for Australia, get 10 caps, move to Scotland, and then qualify for Scotland on residency once you're no longer good enough to play for Australia. The country that you go back to play for can only be the country of your birth or your parents or your grandparents. I'd say sod your grandparents. They're probably dead by now. Should be your parents or you. The country of your birth or your parents' birth, you should be able to go back and play for. I think the time scale is long enough that it kind of prevents people doing things deliberately. I think there should potentially be a cap limit on it. But other than that, I think it's probably, with a few reservations, the best solution to the problem that we've got at the moment, in that these in particular Pacific Island countries are suffering from people, they're good players going to play for countries that will pay them considerably more money.
And that's the key, isn't it? What I fundamentally,
money and glory,
disagree with for this whole thing is the, oh, I'm gutted, I can't play for, please let me play for the country of my birth. I really want to go represent my country, and I feel like I'm being hard done by, when at the very start of it all, they're the ones that jump ship to make a few extra quid, which I've got no problem with. It's a short career. Make all the money you can, but don't act like you're hard done by making that choice, and because you're no longer getting picked, because the next one, the next cab off the rank has passed you by. You've had your 3-4 years or whatever it is, because the next cab's come round and push you out.
Looking squarely at some of the Kiwi fly halves there, right?
Well, you could pick any number of people, right? But the woe is me that I've heard, and the vitriol around some of the things that have been said, like pre this announcement, and when they're the ones that made the decision in the first place, you've got to stick by that, Phil. In my opinion, totally.
But if you take the example of Charles Peartow went to go and play for New Zealand because he was making a damn sight more money playing in New Zealand than he would have been playing back home, and was getting a lot more money and a lot more kudos playing internationally for New Zealand. He then could make a lot more money saying, sod my international career, I'm going to go and play in England, then Ireland, then England again. And now he's going, oh great, I can go back and play for the country of my birth. Well, the reason you couldn't was because you chased money twice. And if you would have even just chased it once and gone to New Zealand and stayed in New Zealand for a bit longer, you wouldn't be past your 5 years now, so you wouldn't be eligible. So he's only eligible because of his double greed, playing for New Zealand and then running away from New Zealand for even more money.
He's not the only one.
He's perfectly entitled to do that. That's fine. And now he's probably going to go and play for the country of his birth and be treated like a hero for doing so. And yeah, I don't know. The whole thing's a bit messed up and is just a demonstration of inequality within the game and within the world in general.
That's what it's really highlighted, is around the inequality that some of the smaller nations possess. And like I say, I've got no problem with these guys traveling around to make a lot of money, right? Short career, it's high impact, it's high energy, right? Fair enough. Go at it, you're good at it. Go and earn your money. But don't pretend like you're the ones being hard done by because you can no longer play international rugby. That is what the whole bullshit thing is for me. So if you're going to go back and play for Tonga, fine. You know, it's one of those things. If you're going to go back and play Samoa, if you're going to go and play for whoever, you know, fine. The likes of, you know, Alex Azovsky, who can play for Italy. The likes of Zach Mercer, who potentially could play for Scotland. Like, whatever. The issue is you're only one manager sacking away from being back in the fold. In rugby, international managers tend to stick around for a little bit longer, and in general, directors of rugby they get a lot longer than they do in football. But it's demonstrable in professional sport that you are only one managerial change away from being the flavour of the month again, or conversely, not being flavour of the month again. So
if it leads to Tongans, Samoans, Fijians going back to play for them, which means that younger up-and-coming Tongan, Samoans, Fijians play for them at a younger stage because they're getting to play with a Charles Pietau or whoever, so that quality of talent pool stays within the country for longer. In 5 or 10 years' time, the reality is you don't really need it.
Yeah. And you know what? If those guys decide to do that and it makes New Zealand that much weaker, then inject it into my dick. Because essentially that is what will happen, and it might even it out a little bit, or you do away with all of these fucking residency rules altogether and you say you play for the country where you were born or your parents were born, and that's it, full stop, done.
And there are issues to that, was it Underhill was born in Germany because his parents were on an Air Force base at the time? What's his name? Toby Faletau. Taulupe Faletau. He was brought up and raised in Wales. He wasn't born there, but he went there at a very young age. Manu Tuilagi. Manu Tuilagi is English. He's been here since he was like pre-teens, and that's kind of if you're raised in a country, I think it's a bit different.
So there will be there'll obviously be nuance,
yeah,
to a certain extent.
And I think if you're in a country by the age of whatever, draw a line in the sand under which kids are not going to be headhunted to go and play rugby
difference. Like let's say pre 15 years old, fine, because you don't know what's going to happen. After that, it's the guys that hop around after got a bit of a sniff of the money or got the, you know, it's your
WP Nels or your James Lowe's or your whatever.
Doug, where are you on this?
I think anything that raises the standard of international rugby across the board and stops the domination of 3 or 4 top teams could be great. I think there's any number of players that represented England that could go on and play for Scotland or you know, any of the smaller nations.
I think where you would go with that.
I think it's a good thing. I did try to have a little rudimentary look for players that would be England players that would be eligible for Scotland and Wales, because I'd rather any England players that were eligible for Ireland didn't play for Ireland. But it turned out to be too much hassle and I couldn't be bothered to finish it, so I didn't. I think it's probably good for the Pacific Islands, but you've also got to ask, in the majority of cases, you're looking at players in almost exclusively in their 30s being added to squads that have sort of got a little bit of a thing going, you know. I'm not sure that adding Tangeli Nairavoro to the Fiji squad makes Fiji better. I mean, adding Richie Mo'unga to Tonga, not Richie Mo'unga, who's the Lima Sopoanga to Tonga, does that make Tonga better? Probably, but does it make them immediately eligible to get to World Cup quarterfinals and semifinals? But probably not. So
I guess
it's arguable or negligible the difference that it'll make, certainly at the next World Cup. Longer term, it may well make a difference, because players could get to the point where they finish a World Cup cycle with one nation and go, well, I'm 27 now. It's hit and miss whether I'll be eligible for the World Cup 4 years, or whether I'll be good enough, or even in the plans to keep playing for England or New Zealand or Australia or at the next World Cup. So do I turn down selection for those nations and look to go to the World Cup in 4 years with my nation of birth or the nation of
if you're a Kiwi back three and you've just done a World Cup cycle, you know you won't be there for the next one, because that's what they do.
Quite. So, but also, I mean, there's any number of nations that you could say that about. So could you, I mean, what would be to stop, for argument's sake, were Gary Graham a little bit better? What's to stop Gary Graham saying, well, I'll go to this World Cup with Scotland, I'll immediately retire from Scotland, and then I'll try and get in the England side for the next World Cup, and I won't play for Scotland for the next 3 years.
I'll give myself 12 months.
Sorry?
I'll give myself 12 months to get in that England squad.
Exactly. And I think you could start seeing players making that kind of decision. Your point about, does there need to be a cap limit? I'm not sure how you can arbitrarily set a cap limit. I mean, Warren Gatland did it for Wales, but I'm not sure that's manageable or even probably legal, given the wording of how they've set out this stuff that's going to happen for next year.
I think the
longer term effect will be that there'll be more South Sea Islanders doing a World Cup cycle from the minute they get to New Zealand to the end of that World Cup, and then going, right, I've done my New Zealand thing, next World Cup, I've got my 20 caps for New Zealand, I'll go and get 70 for Tonga or Fiji.
And with
who cares?
Yeah. Papua New Guinea. With that in mind, what's the stop then? Richer Premiership clubs or Super Rugby franchises paying a player over the odds to declare where there is options one way or the other. So let's, for argument's sake, say a player is born in England to an Australian mother and a New Zealand father. Could happen. What's to stop nations or clubs or offering lucrative contracts for?
Well, nothing. If anything, it'd actually be quite clever, wouldn't it? You could pretty much say, well, how many test matches are you going to play for Australia in the next 3 years? You're going to play 20, 25 test matches for Australia if you pick for everyone, 10 grand to go. You know,
yeah.
How much is that? Do the maths, Phil. 250 grand.
Sounds about right.
We'll stick an extra 250 grand on your contract. You can come and play for us for 3 years for that extra 250 grand for each year. So
we'll buy you a flat in North London as a suite.
Yeah, and then you'll just go and play for Fiji or whatever.
Yeah.
Can be done.
Yeah.
I haven't quite worked this through in my head. I do wonder if it'll reduce the risk of kind of, I don't know if there's a technical term for it, but kind of poaching players and giving them a single cap to stop them moving to other countries.
You're just delaying it for 3 years, aren't you? Potentially.
Well, yeah, if you're capping 17, 18-year-olds because you think they're in...
Well, Ted Hill being the prime example, right?
Well, exactly. In pointless shit summer series, you give them a cap when the Lions are away and you're effectively saying, okay, you're England third team, but now you can't go and play for Scotland or Wales or Ireland or wherever your other country would be. Does that become less useful as a ploy? Because let's be honest, all countries have done it and England are as bad as anybody else for doing it.
Among the worst, I would say.
But does that become less of a ploy if you're taking your 17, 18-year-old and you're saying, well, actually, when you're 21, you can go and get start playing for Wales and get 80 caps for them anyway.
So it doesn't matter, does it?
Discarded you.
So with that in mind, like, and you very rarely see 18, 19-year-olds playing international rugby, even in those summer tours, do you? But
Ted Hill played against New Zealand.
Yeah, he did, yeah, but that's an exception rather than a rule, isn't it?
I still find that staggering that he got one test against New Zealand.
Yeah. Madness. But you could argue that it would happen even more because you could just say, well, you know, I'll pick you now. You can either come and play or not. But you know, in 3 years' time, you can go and play somewhere else if you're not good enough. Come and give it a go. Come and give it a go, lad. You're only young. You're only 20. Have a little game. See if you like it. See if you fit in. If not, give it 3 years, stay at the top of your game, you can go and play someone else. There's even less consequence now, which would make you think it would happen even more rather than less.
I'm not sure it would. I don't think there's the same incentive to cap these players that you're not completely sold on anyway, because what you're going to do, give them a cap every 2.5 years, seems a lot of effort to go through.
But then
getting Bevan Rod.
But then players are even more easier discardable. Not that any international coach, I mean, I can't even think Eddie Jones really cares. Sure, I don't think they care. I don't think they care, mate. I don't think they care about the feelings of the player, whether they've got one cap or 50 caps.
But I don't think they give a shit. Change that. I think.
No, that's. That's what I mean. I don't think it makes a decision, but I think it makes it more. I think it just makes it easier to do it, like compassionately. When I don't think compassion is really a factor. I don't know.
Well, I don't either, Russ.
Okay, but you're disagreeing. But you know, I think I don't know. It's an interesting one, isn't it?
Time will tell, won't it?
Time will tell. Should we leave that there? I mean,
oh, let's sure. Move on. Yeah, let's leave it there, Russ.
What the fuck is the matter with you? He's all giddy, isn't he? He's had a week off. He's been a bit poorly. And now he's fucking giddy.
Bloody hell, I was on my death's door.
Of course you were. You fanny. Doug, let's do some money line. Let's go through the money line for the weekend. And we'll reflect a little bit on the Prem as we go through.
Okay. So we're going to start with the rundown of games. I think there's one, two, three games that are really going to be entertaining this week. There's one that I think could be an absolute shit fest, and two that are okay. So should we start with the worst game of the week, which is actually on Friday night?
Oh, yeah, cool.
Gloucester-Bristol.
The worst game of the weekend, Gloucester-Bristol. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that, would you?
The worst game on the slate this weekend.
Bristol are really struggling, aren't they? It's an odd one this season. Almost, you know, not having that the likes of Rundrandra.
Well, Doug, you said about... we're only three or four games off teams kind of mailing it in because they've got nothing left to play for this season. I think Bristol are probably there. But they're probably there already. Anything not making top four is going to be seen as a failure for them. And I can't see them making top four.
Well, not anymore. It'd be some
five
run.
Games already. Now, obviously, they didn't see him play this week, but... and Northampton are generally playing well. But when I have seen them play this season, they've been really uninspiring.
So Bristol are third from bottom with 14 points. They're currently 11 points out of the top four, which that's a long way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a long way.
Gloucester are sixth. I mean, they have 23 points, but I've watched Gloucester a number of times this year and they're not very good.
Oh, the top, for me, the top four stay as the top four are at the moment.
Well, so you think Northampton are going to stay in the top four over Exeter? I mean, if Northampton get a bonus point win this weekend, they'll be, well, 6 points clear of Exeter.
I called it at the start of the season. I don't think Exeter will make playoffs.
Wow.
It's interesting. We'll come on when we come on to Exeter in a minute. But you know, we said in a season where everybody potentially could beat and might beat anybody, and it just stays really close and no team will really run away with it. Leicester are top at the moment by, 8 points, 7 points. But they're not, no one's running specifically away with it, and I don't think they will. All teams will be resting players. All teams will rotate, and teams will pick up defeats. Some teams will pick up more defeats than others. And I think Exeter will pick up more defeats this season than they have in recent seasons, simply because they just look at the way they're not as good. No, and they're missed. They've been missing some players through injury. I think
Wasps or Gloucester here?
Let's talk Bristol and Gloucester, because that's what you're talking about. So on the money line, where is the game? Is it at King's Home on Friday night, Doug?
The game is at Gloucester. So
okay.
Yes. Gloucester to me are a funny team. They don't have many start. I mean, when you've got Billy 12 Trees running in 40 meter tries, Ollie Thorley seems to have. I mean, maybe Eddie Jones was right about Ollie Thorley, because he's done nothing this season, from what I can see. They seem to get away with it quite a bit. I love their new number eight. He's played, I think, eight or nine games for them. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Someone will be shouting at their radio. But I can't remember. He looked a very good player. But just...
Clement,
there's the boy. He looks a decent player. But I don't know. They're just two teams that just are lacking something for me. I'm not sure what. I mean, you could say Bristol are lacking a Semi Randrando, but yeah.
I think Bristol are missing more than that. But I don't know. I think Gloucester, because we're so used to them doing a Gloucester and looking half decent for about 15 minutes and looking despicably average for about 50 and then throwing it away at the end of it. Actually, for all of that, they lost their first three matches of the season, and then they've been squeaking wins left, right, and centre. And I think they'll do it again against Bristol, to be honest. But I think that's probably more a reflection of Bristol than it is of Gloucester.
I think Bristol were so exceptional last season. I think they were for 95% of last season, they were quite convincingly the best team. They're probably the best team to watch. I mean, a lot of Harlequins fans will disagree with that, but I think as a team, and when they lost that semi-final in extra time, you know, when it just felt like that Bristol bubble just completely burst, and they're struggling to get back any continuity off the back of it. And you talk about teams having their window, you know, Bristol seems to have slammed firmly shut off the back of that semi-final. Having said that, the way that Gloucester tend to play, and the games I've watched them this season, on that newly crowned plastic pitch, you know, like Kenilworth Road was in the 80s, Doug. That's the
Kenilworth Road in the 80s, mate, was one of the worst places to play football in the country. I played on it.
On that plaster, proper old school plastic
proper
pitch.
Old school AstroTurf plastic.
Yeah. That. Real hard, sandy, like playing on concrete, basically.
Yeah, it was horrendous.
But obviously, Gloucester's 4G isn't like that. But yeah. I think that.
Also, Gloucester's 4G, one of the most stupefying decisions I've ever known in rugby. I don't understand why they felt the need to do it. They had a decent track.
I know, yeah.
And a decent track and a history of forward based rugby.
Yeah. Man. Real odd. I'm going to say that on the money line this week, that in my opinion, it should be Bristol by a hair. But I think based on form and the fact that Gloucester are at home, the money line will say Gloucester by five.
Eight.
Gloucester by
eight.
Five.
Yeah.
I reckon Gloucester by eight. They've only lost one since 24th of September.
But the bookies have got Bristol.
No, they've actually got Gloucester by four. So
Here we go. Now we're cooking.
Gloucester by four. I find that staggering. I both teams will do their best not to win. But I think I'm going to say a draw on this one.
Oh, imagine.
Yeah. The other game that no one's going to care about, Worcester against Wasps.
Couldn't care less.
I mean, what, Wasps by 10?
Wasps by, 15.
Russ is going to get that one again.
It's of course he is.
Wasps by three? Yeah, wow. I mean, I was at the Wasps game on Friday, and their centre partnership was Michael LeBourgeois and Josh Bassett. And Gloucester, it's no wonder Billy 12-tree was running tries in from 40 yards, because that is not a centre partnership that would be striking fear into the hearts of many, is it?
Josh Bassett played at 13.
They had Josh Bassett at 12, I think.
What?
And LeBourgeois at 13 with Francois Houhart on the wing.
Oh, yeah, they had players drop out late, didn't they?
Yeah,
they
and late. I've got to be honest, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I even said it on Talkback quite loud and I hope nobody at Wasps heard it. But Jacob Umanga, if his name was Jacob Smith, would be playing in National 2.
Yeah, I do not see it at all.
He is
slow.
Hopeless. He knocks the ball defend. All the time, makes bad decisions, he wears leggings. Yeah. It's just... The whole thing is just a bad look.
Got shit hair as well, hasn't he?
Oh, goodness me. Honestly, he is comfortably, for me, one of the worst fly halves in the Premiership. And another thing we should revisit is the Dalton line for the fly halves.
Yeah.
Through the season.
Interestingly, you say they started Houhart on the wing and Bassett in the centres.
Yeah.
Yet kept Gopeth on the bench.
Yeah.
I don't think Gopeth wants to start this season. I don't. Well, I think he's got.
I
no
mean, but
that's because he's 908.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. But surely, surely, if you're the director of Rugby at Wasps and you've got the choice of putting Josh Bassett at 12 and bringing Houhart on the wing, or saying to your, you know, one of your premier backs, even if you are 45, mate, you got to start at 12 here because.
Listen, mate. If he'd have played in the Maul Over Invitational, he would have been comfortably the oldest player on the pitch.
And given that every time he goes near kicking a ball, all the commentators talk about is how he was brought up kicking in really windy Taranaki. Like, he'd be perfect.
Where he hasn't played for roughly 35 years.
He'd be perfect for kicking in those kind of conditions on
35 years since he was a Colt.
Yeah. I think the most worrying thing about that game was the crowd. There was no one there, even for Wasps.
That was mentioned. I saw that mentioned on Twitter by someone about, like, there was a couple of crowds less than 4,000 crowds. There was one obviously at Newcastle, which was the late postponement and time shift and stuff. But there were a couple of others where less than 4,000 people attended. That'd probably be less than League Two football. Plymouth Argyle had 15,000 people there.
Did they really?
Yeah, regularly getting over 10,000 people. Plymouth. Regularly,
tells
every
you
home game.
To know about the product at the moment.
Yeah.
So moving on, Russ, you're 2-0 up. You need one more to avoid the defeat.
It's about time.
We'll go for the least sexy of the two remaining games. Northampton against Bath at the Cinch Stadium at
the
Franklin's Garden.
The Cinch Stadium. Fucking suck.
That can do on. I don't even really want to talk about this now, Doug, now you've said that.
Okay, give me a number, because it's nearly your bedtime.
Okay. Saints by 9.
Russ?
It'll be more than that, but...
So, I saw signs of life in Bath on Friday night. Watching Bath against Exeter. And Exeter haven't been great this season. But
the pack looked really good the first half.
Bath pack looked really good first half. They lacked a bit when Miles Reed went off. I thought he was outstanding for the time that he was on the pitch. And he really drove them forward. He sort of encompasses the energy that you want from your back row. And him and Underhill really, really drove them forward. I really like the look of Max Ajomo. We talk about him a lot, but Josh McNally is... He's a great player, and he pisses all over Charlie Yules. I mean, and I'm not a second row, but I watched the pair of them get around the pitch, and Charlie Yules is lazy by comparison.
The other great thing about Josh McNally is that 3 minutes into a game, he looks like he's played for 97 minutes.
Yeah, he looks exactly the same.
He takes his tracksuit top off and immediately looks fucked.
Yeah,
he looks the same minute one. Minute 80.
Yeah. And Bath had Bayliss was the other one who was really good. And Bath seemed to control the game really well in the first half. They kept possession. They forced Exeter to make mistakes. I thought that, Spencer kicked brilliantly. And where Bath lost it really was in the second half. After sort of 65 minutes, they were up. They were comfortable. And they took off Spencer and Bailey in a double substitution, brought on Joe Simpson and Danny Cipriani, old stable door Cipriani and his, or saloon door Cipriani and his defensive capability. And they took off
tackle to make,
2 minutes late. No, it wasn't, but the scrum was being harmonised. So Ellis, yes, it's Ellis's tackle to make, but the scrum was going backwards. And if he'd stepped off that scrum, even for half a second, it would have been a penalty try anyway, probably. So he had to make a decision. And Simmons is so quick. He's so quick that I'm not entirely sure he would have made that tackle, even if he was ready for it.
Phil, I was going to ask you a question, actually.
I'm not buying that at all.
I want to ask you a question about that try.
Yeah,
I've watched it a number of times, and it seems like Joe Simpson doesn't communicate that
100%.
Simmons picks the ball up, because the Bath 8 still got his head up the second row's arse as he crosses the line.
100%, yeah. So you got two things there. Ellis has to at least be looking through his eyebrows, because you know Simmons is going to pick and go there. 100%, you know he's going to do it. So he's got to be at least...
telegraphed it by switching out to the open side, right? So he went into the gap between the flanker and the 8 rather than... Yeah.
Yeah, which says, I'm not pushing, I'm waiting for that ball to come and then I'm going with it. It was absolutely telegraphed. And he's got to, at the very least, have his chin off his chest and have his eyes open. And then as soon as you see the guy's feet move, or you're watching the ball, and as soon as the hands are on the ball, you can get up and you can move.
He didn't even let a glove on him, Phil.
He was still bound
when Simmons was over the try line.
That's what now, and that was Simmons, the flanker.
Does Simmons still score the try? Probably, but he has to at least move. But you're right, the second point on that is Simpson's got to be absolutely screaming that the ball's gone. And at least then it's somebody else's responsibility.
Do you not think, though, like from a defensive point of view, yes, you've got to trust your flanker to make a tackle, but in that area, they are dead underneath the middle of the posts. You would almost have like a guard on either side that says, well, you know, if he's going to pick and they're make him ship it wide, make him do something. If we have a guard either side that's going to meet him as well as the flanker from either side, then at least we got half a chance. If we're going to make him pass, anything could happen, but at least they'll score wide.
Yeah. Yeah, and
do you see what I mean? So you
can
condense your defense.
You have your
centers literally as a guard on either side of the scrum.
Could they? Well,
you only need it on the open side, because your 9 should be able to at least slow them down to give your blind side a chance to get up.
Say what you're going to say there, though, because that might have just popped into my head as well.
Well, could you not have taken your flankers off the scrum and put in your wingers to play as flankers and then stood your flankers on the posts?
I think you're asking for a penalty try if you do that.
Right.
Especially as the...
Because you're signposting it so strongly.
I mean, yeah, and I guess the refs going to be concertina'd in the scrum previous, didn't they? So
yeah. But I mean,
you could take Underhill off. I mean, I'm not sure he was on the pitch. I think Rocco Degouni was off, wasn't he?
Yeah, Rocco was off. Yeah, it was McConaughey and Muir, wasn't it, on the wings?
Well, you could put Muir's basically a second row anyway.
Yeah, it's flipping huge. You could play him on the flank. Yeah,
yeah.
But the other point I wanted to make about Bath is that when Tom Dunn was people talking about him for England selection, and I think he was in the squad and then he got a couple of injuries at just the wrong time. And he was this absolute tackling machine who would just smash anything and everything that moved and would hit his arrows pretty well as well. And he's just turned into an absolute liability. He's a penalty machine. He gives away 3 or 4 stupid penalties every match for just diving over the ball or arguing with the ref or just stepping over offside or something. And if you played with him, you just want somebody to drag him aside and go, "What the fuck are you doing, you dick? Just chill your beans a bit."
Yeah.
I think Bath Spence let them down.
He got a lot of hype after that Northampton game, didn't he? Where he, where he was shouting, "Yeah, take the scrum. And then they beat up one of the worst scrums in Premiership history.
Yeah.
Maybe that's sort of gone to his head. Let's move on, Russ. You said, Phil, you said +9, didn't you? Saints. Russ?
It's. I'm going to go more than that. I'm going to go Saints +12.
Okay, well, it's actually Saints by 9. So,
Phil gets that one right still there. In it.
Extends the competition somewhat. So we've got 3 games left, all pretty good. The worst of the 3, in my view, London Irish against the Falcons.
You and me both, Russ, saw a chunk of the Irish game against Quins, and they looked really good. They've assembled a squad of mid 30-year-old quality internationals.
They've augmented by a load of kids that are brilliant.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, exactly. And in Jackson, Coleman, Simmons, and Crevy, they've got quality there.
Rona, Rona was unbelievable. Class. He ran into Luke Northmore at one point, and Northmore did not know what day of the week it was.
He tried tackling him with his forehead.
Yeah, it was fucking ridiculous.
If Tom Pardon had just made 2 different decisions.
No, it was Hassel Collins twice.
It's Hassel Collins, yeah.
And they would have been out of sight. Right, yeah. It was a lot tighter than it had to be for Irish, because all Hassel Collins had to do was pass it once on 2 occasions and it was a walk-in. But Nick Phipps and Jackson and, let's say, Creevy, Adam Coleman, I think, is underrated and doesn't really get the kudos he deserves for his leadership role in that team. I think he's brilliant. And Rogerson as well. And they, let's say, the back 3, when they had Loader playing, Hassel Collins, they had a guy called Rowe, Scottish lad called Rowe, playing on the wing on Saturday. Got caught out a little bit on the first half. Yeah. But they're a good little team, London Irish. And what I like about Irish is, even like, they've got a real dogged attitude. There's at least 2 or 3 occasions in the last 18 months where they've been the best part of 30 points down, and they've come back to draw or win. And there's a lot of teams in the Premiership that would have just fucking mailed it in by then. And that's what I like about them.
Well, they've drawn 3 games so far this season, which must be some kind of record.
Three out of nine is mad. Yeah. Anyway, right, get on the money line.
Newcastle look like they're going the other way. They look like they started firing on all cylinders and are just faltering a bit.
I think Newcastle are.
Worcester, you need to throw that result out because, it was a rearranged fixture. It was belting down with snow, I think. Newcastle are a decent side, although Carl Ferns remains the most overrated player in Premiership history.
I'm going to say Irish by 6.
I'm going more than that, and I'm going to say Irish by 10.
Phil gets it again, Irish by 7.
Oh, fuck. Ooh.
Two each. Okay, a couple of good games to end them. Well, certainly one on the Saturday that will be entertaining. I think this is the BT game, but Exeter against Saracens.
It's surely got to be the BT game, isn't it? Like, if it isn't, it's then...
Yeah, I think it is. Let me tell you, because I... Oddly, I should know that because I put together the camera crews for this weekend. So...
Are you in the hub again?
Yeah, at the hub, we've got Irish Newcastle, Worcester Wasps, and I'm directing Northampton Bath this weekend.
Nice.
So...
Big shot.
Any TMO decisions against Northampton might be...
Kind of a big deal.
Oh, wait, you know.
Just make sure you get the right angles, though, yeah?
Yeah, cheers, mate.
The referee's not been announced yet, though. That usually comes a bit later in the
week. You know, you're wearing that hoodie.
Yeah.
It makes you look like you're a bellend emerging from a foreskin.
In need of a trim.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's one thing my head doesn't need, it's a trim. Right. It's an interesting one, this, because
not really.
it is because there'll be a bit of needle in it. I think that we'll see Exeter play their strongest side, which I don't think they've done yet this season. They've been given a lot of game time to Harvey Skinner. They've played a few of the youngsters in the front row as well. Having said all that, from what I've seen from Saracens this season, it's like they've never been away. The game against Sale on Sunday, even good at 10 with Lazowski or Tompkins and Lazowski outside him, they look fearsome. Itoje is at his best. Billy and Mako seems to have a new lease of non-international life. Like, they look fresh and fit. Did you watch any of the game yesterday?
I watched it all, yeah.
What did you make of the Ben Austin and Ben Kay. What did you make of them and all they were wanking on about Swinson binding at the rucks? Did you see that?
What about the sort of reverse caterpillar?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's the most Saracens thing that they could have ever done this season, right? They've come up with a method to cheat legally.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant.
Can you cheat legally? I don't know. This is technically not cheating, but...
Well, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. So I think it's brilliant. And you could technically then say that if I'm bound, you can swing 5 players down the side of a caterpillar, right?
Yeah. Like caterpillar off a caterpillar, then you're not, yeah. Then you're all still bound. It's certainly, it will be interesting to see where they take it. But the Saracens just look completely the big red machine that they were previously, or the big black machine. You know,
yeah, I mean, it must just be so demoralizing. Like, I've seen it a million times, but 7 phases in, and you've moved the ball 8 inches. And
Sale are so used to dominating sides physically. The Dupria brothers beating teams up up front, Van der Merwe, you know, Van Rensburg breaking the gain line. And they just did not go anywhere. They didn't go anywhere. And when McGuigan got himself sent off for basically being a twat, you know, and he deserved every inch of that. Just get yourself, you're getting sent off, Byron, you're getting sent off because you're a fucking twat. And you deserve it. Not because it was dangerous, not because it was really foul play, but because you were a bit of a twat. So you deserve to get sent off. See you later.
Yeah.
That's what I'd love the conversation with Matt Carley to go like. Because everybody watching that would have gone, yeah, agreed. Thanks very much. But I think this will be an absolutely fascinating game. I think it'll be really, really good to watch. But for money line purposes, I think it will be Saracens by 5.
I'll be honest, I am less positive from an Exeter perspective. I don't think they've been holding back quite as much as Russ is implying. I think they've actually been trying to play some of their better teams and they're just not clicking. There are players getting a lot of game time who probably wouldn't have done if everybody was fit, and they're still missing some players that I think is really punishing them. And yeah, it's their game, their whole game plan isn't clicking. Whereas Saracens, bit of a rocky start, but it's like they've never been away again, as Russ says. And I think the reality is that Saracens are probably going to win by more than 2 clear tries. But for the purposes of this, what did you say, Russ?
5.
I'm going to go 8.
And it's 3. So Russ gets that one. So Phil, you've got to take this one. I'd just like to point out that so far this season, Saints have beaten Gloucester, Bristol, Exeter, and did we beat Harlequins? Or maybe we didn't. We've beaten some good teams this year. That's all I want to say. Last game then, and it is the last game. It's on Sunday. It's at the Mattioli Wood Stadium at Welford Road. Leicester Tigers against Harlequins.
These fucking sponsored stadium names are utter toilet, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it is awful. Can I say that word without it being picked up? From a rugby club perspective, it's like bending over and taking one straight up the sphincter, but then getting paid 50 grand for it.
Yeah. Do you know what Mattioli Woods is?
Solicitors.
Yeah, wealth management.
Wealth management.
I mean, I don't even know what wealth, asset management at Mattioli Woods.
There you go.
It's for people with more money than you and me, Russ.
We could do the tropey kind of, clash of styles, this and that. I think the larger point on this game is that Harlequins actually need to pull something out of their arseholes, don't they? Because the wheels are coming off a little bit.
They are. And the fact that Leicester are in such great form kind of leans itself to everyone saying, oh yeah, Leicester are going to, just steamroller all over Quins. And the likelihood is that Smith and Don Brandt will be back. I think Quins have really suffered, and I said it all along. The minute those two guys are out of the team, they look a completely different entity. And that has kind of been the case. Esther Hazen was doing his best. Even Tommy Allen went off in the first half of the game on Saturday. And they, the lad who came on, whilst he did an okay job, he's not Marcus Smith. And no one really is. So
the facts are that they could find themselves in sixth position after this weekend.
Yeah.
Which considering how they've been anointed as the chosen ones.
Well, says a lot. It does. It's Smith versus Ford. That would be an interesting battle with regards to game management. Obviously, whoever's pack gets on top will have an easier day.
There's only one pack going to be on top, right? It's how Quins deal with that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I think depending on if Don Brandt's available, I think Kenningham has been, has been a constant shining light for them. I'm really impressed with Kenningham. How they fit in around it. Marla, who did they have in the row on Saturday? They had Marla with...
I tell you the player they're really missing is that back rower that got injured.
Yeah.
Will Evans.
Luke Wallace.
Will Evans. Will Evans. Yeah, not Luke Wallace and his dislocated hip.
He dislocated his hip.
Yeah, Luke Wallace did, yeah.
Oh god.
Yeah, no thanks. Will Evans, you're right, yeah.
I think they really miss him. It's a real shame. I thought he was England level good when I saw him last year.
I mean the back row for Quins on Saturday against Irish was Chisholm, Lorde and Kenningham.
Lorde's decent, Lorde, mate.
I thought Lorde looked all right. I thought he played really, really well. And I thought
Stefan Levis
played a pretty good game as well.
This is where we need Ben here,
isn't it? Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the Leicester pack are just doing things at the moment. And, I just, even with Smith back, I just think everything's clicking in the right way and the right time for them. And I think the bookies all...
off a bye week, Leicester, as well, that extra week's rest, whether that comes into it or not. I mean, I don't know what the stats are for teams coming off bye weeks this season. But, you know, I can't imagine it would make that much difference. Nice. Why would we change the habit of a lifetime?
Exactly. No, I'm going to go Leicester by 5.
I'm going to say... more Leicester by 8.
And the winner of this week's I guess the lines is no one, because Phil wins. It was Leicester by 4.
Do I not win by virtue of getting one exactly spot on?
No, you don't.
Thank you. Thanks for that. Should we get on to some any other business, considering Roger, we're already past Phil's bedtime? This nice quick pod is, cool. Phil, you go first then.
Just want to speak very quickly about coronavirus. There was a long thread on the Twitter group about coronavirus that I tried to keep out of and then told Russ that he was talking shit. But you know what? People are allowed opinions and that's perfectly fine. You're allowed to feel how you feel about stuff. You're allowed to feel that you don't want to have a mask on, or you don't want to be told what to do, or you don't want to take the risk of going outside because you're worried about it. You're allowed to be afraid. That's all good. What you're not allowed to do, and what pisses me off, is when people make up shit and make up lies. Facts are facts. Opinions are opinions. And there's people on both sides of the argument making up lies to back up their argument. And you know what? Just say how you're feeling and behave how you want to feel. And that's fine by me. That's it.
Fair one. Douglas?
A couple of things this week. First off, Russ coming through absolutely clutch again and getting the cricket ticket. So big thanks to you for that.
Yeah, we're going to the test match.
Never in my life have I ever met such a doer.
I think in
apart from the assistant.
Mark two.
Yeah.
I think they call it in with the guys I play golf with, they call it being a busy cunt.
You are a busy cunt, yeah. Without a shame. There was something else that I wanted to say, but it's completely gone out of my head. Ball bags. That's annoyed me. I guess we'll never know.
I haven't really got anything. There's a couple of bits of news that are making me laugh around this whole Maxwell and Epstein case that they're banning all media and all people from the courtroom from, like it's some kind of weird conspiracy. Tottenham Premiership football still being called off at the last minute because of a bit of snow. I find that fucking incredible in this day and age that can still happen.
Just get the orange ball out.
They were still trying to clear the snow with brushes. And, you know, it might have been a Scottish league football, where they had basically a snow plow on the front of a Isuzu Trooper or something. And they were just literally just driving this wagon all over the pitch, just
that name
clearing
again is Mr. Plow.
You listened to last week's Long Supper.
I remember what my other AOB was.
Go on, Em.
About 2 years ago, I started following this ex-Gurkha on Twitter.
Who are you going to say? This ex-girlfriend? I started following my ex-girlfriend.
Mate, if I followed all my ex-girlfriends on Twitter, I'd be following upwards of 6 people. I started following this ex-Gurkha on Twitter, who was an ex special forces soldier who left the military and was planning on climbing all 14 of the highest peaks in the world, which are all over 8,000 meters. And he was doing it in as short a time as possible. And I happened to turn on Netflix today, and lo and behold, there's a documentary about it. It's an hour and 40 minutes long, so it's a bit of a commitment. But this dude is, I mean, he's not human. What he did and what, like, his outlook on life and the way he carries himself and everything else about him is, if you've heard nothing about it, I would advise you watch it. The guy's name is Nims Purja, and he climbed all 14.
Sounds like a bit of a superhero.
Well, mate, he was a Gurkha, so he's already pretty mental.
Yeah.
B, he was in the SBS, so...
Even more mental.
C, he's climbed an 8,000 meter peak, which... I've literally got a book, and I can say that because I have got multiple books about people who have climbed one 8,000 meter peak in their life. You're and they managed to get a novel out of that shit. He was climbing three in 48 hours.
Wow.
He's not, it's an incredible story. And if you should watch it.
Cool.
And I'm quickly
Googling the title.
What the name of the documentary is, because I can't remember. I think it's Mission Possible. Nothing is impossible.
Fantastic.
Unless you want to piss out your elbow. That is impossible. How was it? 14 peaks. Okay.
All right.
14 peaks.
Excellent. Sorry. Excellent. Let's leave it there, because... I could go into some other bits about people losing their minds about TV shows like Strictly and I'm a Celebrity, because there was, you know, the camp was destroyed by Wind and people are going, why isn't I'm a Celebrity on? This is the disgrace. Fucking grow up. Absolutely grow up. Anyway, that's it. Let's go, because Phil, I can already see Phil.
Sleep well.
And we will see you all next week.
I'm half asleep already.
Go well.
Cheers, boys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.